This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. This year marks the 450th birthday of William Shakespeare, and worldwide celebrations earlier this year are further evidence that his work continues to transcend racial, ethnic, and geographic boundaries. The poet and playwright has become a cultural phenomenon studied by scholars and writers around the world. But my guest today argues that to better understand Shakespeare, we should learn more about the historical context in which he lived and worked. Lena Orlin is a scholar who has spent months in the archives in Shakespeare's hometown of Stratford-upon-Avon, and she has some new insights into his life and his marriage. Lena is a professor at Georgetown University, the executive director of the Shakespeare Association of America, and currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park. She's working on a book about the private life of William Shakespeare, and she joins us now in the studio to tell us more. Lena Orlin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
You're an English professor. You've spent your career researching archives. Tell us what drew you to this work in the first place.
The archival work? Yeah. My background is in English literature, so I read Shakespeare and teach Shakespeare. But I also spent a period of time at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., which some of your listeners will be familiar with. And while there, I essentially had a postdoctoral education in historical research, and that's where I spend most of my time at this point.
You have a different approach to looking at Shakespeare than other biographers, and of course all biographers have a problem, I understand, because there's not a lot of at least documentary evidence about his life.
Yeah, that's right. The evidence doesn't by any means match the interest. The first biography of Shakespeare was actually written in 1709. It was a man named Nicholas Rowe, who was Shakespeare's first editor, who was a playwright, and who included a biography in which he said that he could understand why people might be interested in the poet himself, and that knowing something about the poet's life might make it possible to understand the works better. But what happened within about 50 years of that is that a man named William Oldys set out to write the second biography of Shakespeare, and he turned everything around. He read some of the sonnets as being biographically revelatory, and that's basically the path that has been followed since then, because there's so little historical evidence for Shakespeare's life. People have been looking for clues in the works themselves. Most of the biographies of Shakespeare have been written by literary scholars, so they write literary biographies, calling on the plays, calling on the poems. And I'm trying to set those aside and just look at historical evidence.
I want to talk more about your approach to understanding him a little bit better. But the idea that you could somehow pull from the literature, from his work, a view of the man strikes me as difficult only because of the scope of his work, the breadth and depth of each of those characters and how diverse those characters are. How would you figure out where Shakespeare is in all of that?
You know, I think there's, in the past decade or so, there's probably been a new biography every 6 months. And so everybody's looking for something that nobody's noticed before. Mm-hmm. The man named Oldys, who started out in the 1760s, read a sonnet in which Shakespeare used the phrase, like a deceived husband. And he said, undoubtedly, this sonnet was written by Shakespeare, who was in some suspicion of the infidelity of his beautiful wife. Now, we don't know that Shakespeare's wife was beautiful. We don't know that she was unfaithful. In fact, the sonnet was written metaphorically, like a deceived husband, because it was written to a man. It was one of the homoerotic sonnets. So everything about that was wrong. But that was the hint that got picked up and that got carried forward. Today, in biographies, we'll have people. There's one man, for example, who takes a sonnet in which Shakespeare used the metaphor lame, and he argues, well, Shakespeare must have been crippled. Perhaps he suffered a fall from a horse. Maybe it was spina bifida. He spells out all the alternatives that could have explained the reason that Shakespeare limped. I agree with you. Shakespeare imagined himself into so many different characters. That's long been the appeal of the author. Imagined himself into so many different lives, right, that we can't really know which was the one that actually resonated with his own life.
Exactly. I guess the reason his work has survived for 450 years is the absolute power of his imagination to create whole characters. So trying to find him and them seems to be a fool's errand. But you take a very different approach. Tell us how you do this.
Well, I went back to Shakespeare's hometown, which is Stratford-on-Avon, which is quite unusual for having a number of records that we wouldn't expect the town to have. They don't tell us much about Shakespeare himself. His father turns up in the records a lot because his father was a tradesman in the town and because he served in town office. But Shakespeare quite deliberately chose a different path. And so because he didn't replicate his father's life, that's why we don't know very much about him. He left town. He went to London. He started writing plays. He lived an unusual life.
You also got some information by researching a Tudor businesswoman. Tell us about that.
Yeah, because I was interested in the life of in Shakespeare's family life and in the life of his wife left behind. I was reading as widely as I could about the lives of other people in Stratford, came across a quite remarkable woman who has many points of analogy with Shakespeare's wife, Anne Hathaway. But because her husband did practice a trade in the town, because he was in civic office, he left a lot of records. She turns up in a lot of records. So she's much more fully documented than Shakespeare's wife, Anne Hathaway, was.
Well, and we think, I mean, you suggest that what we think we know about Anne Hathaway might also be wrong.
Yeah, well, ever since this man named Oldys, people have assumed that Shakespeare disliked his life and his wife and despised her. What happened that set everybody on the path to assume that this was an unhappy marriage was that people discovered, first of all, they believe that she's 8 years older than he, and they couldn't accommodate the notion of an older wife. Secondly, she was pregnant when they wed. In fact, this was quite common in the period and was not a particular source of scandal or shame. Thirdly, in his will, he left her his second best bed, which people assumed to have been a slight and an insult. And so ever since then, they've assumed that it was an unhappy marriage. My theory, looking at the life of this other woman to whom I referred, is that it was an active economic partnership. I don't know anything about their personal relationship or their romantic relationship, but I think that they worked effectively at a project that both were interested in, which was advancement. And Shakespeare did very well for himself. He couldn't have done as well, have accumulated property, have become a gentleman, if he didn't have the collaboration of his wife.
This is the second time we've heard about a business collaboration with a woman, the businesswoman whose background you looked into, and Anne Hathaway, suggesting that there were some changes going on in this period in terms of opportunities for everyone. Shakespeare moves up in class, but for women in particular, is that right?
It is true. It was an expanding economy, the transition to a proto-capitalist economy, the transition to a capitalist economy. There are lots of ways in which women were disadvantaged. We're all most familiar with the fact that they had legal disabilities. They couldn't, many of them, hold property in their own names. They weren't eligible for civic office. They sometimes couldn't take lawsuits forward. There are many ways in which they were discriminated against politically, but they had a lot of range economically. And so what I'm interested in is the power they found through making their own money and contributing to the resources of the family and to setting their sons and daughters up for better lives as well.
So moving to a cash economy, and as you say, the proto-capitalist economy does create different possibilities. Also, there is an industry that's relatively new, this kind of mass entertainment industry that Shakespeare finds himself involved in. I mean, how important is that in the fact that Shakespeare is born then in that period to the life and career of the bard?
You know, I don't think anybody, certainly I don't think Shakespeare's father, would have thought that he could have made a life and career in the theater. It was such a new enterprise that I think that there was a lot of risk involved and a lot of uncertainty. What his wife did was actually, I think, much more normalized. She stayed at home and made money the way people were used to making money in that town.
How did she do that?
One of the things that she did was sell malt for the making of beer. There's some evidence that she was herself a brew maker. She managed property. Most of the property that Shakespeare accumulated was back in Stratford, and she was the one who was managing the various lands and houses that he owned. She took in a lodger, and she also provided the town, served the town, was paid by the town, remunerated by the town for offering some civic hospitality in addition.
So that's how she's making her money. And then you're talking about the risk then. Shakespeare is off in this brand new field. He's pioneering in, sort of the dot-com revolution of his time. And he does very well. But the industry is growing. So tell us about the relationship between this market for this kind of mass entertainment and his place in that market in this time.
Shakespeare was very clever. It wasn't easy to make a lot of money if you were a playwright. We have very few records about this sort of thing. But there is a record that indicates that a man who got paid to write a play was paid less than was spent on the production of one female costume for the same play. Yeah. So that wasn't remunerative. But he was smart enough to get a share of the theater company with which he was involved, which meant he got some portion of the gate, the sale of the tickets. And because he was a shareholder, that's really how he advanced in the industry and was able to advance economically as well.
So again, you're having to read sort of in the shadows to get some of this information. Wills is one of the ways you can do this. Let's go back to this phrase you used earlier. It is one that suggested to many biographers the phrase, his second best bed, what he left to his wife, suggests he didn't like her very much. You seem to think that we need to understand more about what the second best bed was.
That's really how I got into this project, because I read a lot of wills. And I mean, this will sound extremely geeky, but I've read thousands of wills. They're really entertaining as a genre because they're so revealing and so personal, many of them. But one of the things that struck me as I read wills was how many times I came across the phrases best, worst, second best. The fact was that anybody who had two cows had a best cow and a worst cow. And he left his best cow and his worst cow. And they weren't anything other than identifiers. That is, anybody coming in after his death and trying to sort out his property could tell instantly by looking at the cows which was the best one and which was the worst one. They weren't particularly grammatical. They liked superlatives. So there was a best cow and a worst cow. And the same was true of beds. The same was true of kettles. The same was true of coats and cloaks and any kind of household equipment. The term was used simply in order to identify the object that the testator wished to leave. We don't know why Shakespeare left the second best of his beds to his wife. We don't know whether that was a bed with which they had personal associations, whether it was the bed that she had owned before they were married. We don't have any way of knowing exactly why it was that was the one he set apart. But we do know that it was not the only thing he left her, and that it was not the only that it was not an insult towards her. One of the things that people haven't realized in looking at the will is that she would have been protected legally, that she was entitled to a third of all the property he had accumulated during his lifetime for the length of her lifetime. So she was set up and provided for. The bed was a kind of gesture on top of the fact that she was already protected economically for the remainder of her life.
We're looking at the biography of Will Shakespeare today on The State of Things. Lena Orlin is with me. She's currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center in RTP. She teaches at Georgetown University. Who got the best bed?
It's an open question, but it was probably his principal heir, the first of his two daughters. He had three children. The son died, and he left most of his property to the older daughter.
We talked about the difficulty in obtaining any documentary evidence on the life of Shakespeare. However, his birthplace has relatively more documentation. Tell us about that.
In Stratford.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have been interested in Shakespeare from the 16th century. People were starting to visit Stratford, to visit his grave from the 16th century. And people were turning over records in town and looking for Shakespeare's name everywhere imaginable from the 17th and 18th centuries. The consequence is that Stratford-on-Avon has an enormous amount of papers that people have managed to save because of their interest in Shakespeare. The papers didn't necessarily relate to Shakespeare specifically. They didn't necessarily mention his name, but they filled out the picture of what his life was like in the time that he was living there.
Hey, well, go ahead. Please finish.
No, it's an extraordinarily rich resource. And one of the things that has survived is, in addition to the usual things you would expect in town records, like minutes of aldermen's meetings and financial accounts and so on, is a group of personal correspondence from people who lived in town at the same time as Shakespeare did, and so it's probably an underexploited resource for his life.
Correspondence by people who he may have known, but relatively little from him and to him, right?
There's one letter written to Shakespeare directly, which was written by the husband of the woman to whom I was referring before, and which was a request for a loan of £30. That's the only letter we have written to Shakespeare. And in fact, because it survived in the records of the man who wrote it, it probably was not delivered to Shakespeare.
Why do you think he didn't write a lot of letters? I mean, Lord knows he could write.
Yeah, he probably did. But there are more things that have been lost than have survived.
Right.
And there's a story about somebody coming into his daughter's house after his death and taking away books and papers. And probably there were papers of his included there, and we don't know what happened to them.
Has all of this work changed your approach to his text and his work?
I've tried to maintain a kind of firewall between his work and the life story for the very reason you said before, which is that I don't want to be tempted to read from the plays into his life because I think that's misleading. So I haven't gone the other way either, but I'm hoping that looking at his life in this different way make it possible for people to think differently about him and about the works.
Well, and let me ask you, that's the bigger question. Should we care? In other words, we're interested in this person. We do want to know about him. But should it at all influence the way we understand his work?
I don't think we ever will. I think the reason people are interested in Shakespeare's biography is they want to be able to explain him. They want to know where the genius came from. They want to account for it. I don't think it's possible. I don't think there's any way to pin down where genius of that magnitude came from. I hope that we can understand a little bit better what the possibilities were for, say, women in the period, what the possibilities were for men like Shakespeare who are aspirational, so that we have a different idea of what history looked like, what has brought us to the point we're at today. But for the works themselves, I think that that's open to the interpretation of every reader without any explanation for where it came from, because that's, I don't think anything we'll ever understand.
I appreciate your being here. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Georgetown University English professor and National Humanities Center fellow Lena Orland talking about her work and her research into the private life of William Shakespeare. Lena's going to give a lecture about her new take on Shakespeare's life and marriage at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park tomorrow at 5 p.m. And you can get more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is helping out today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.